I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Sometimes a city's influence goes beyond its borders, well into the region. Saskia Sassen is professor of sociology and a member of the Committee on Global Thought at Columbia University. Her work focuses on globalization and global cities. In fact, Saskia invented the term global cities. We'll speak with her about the idea of denationalization and how it applies to urban spaces. We'll also speak with Richard Longworth. He's the author of a recent book called Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. We'll talk with Dick about globalization's impact on the American Midwest. All that, plus the news from PlanetiZen's Nate Berg and our City Views commentator Walker Smith, coming up on today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Saskia Sassen is an author, professor, and sociologist at Columbia University and at the London School of Economics. She has studied and written about the effects of globalization on nations, on cities, and on people, and we caught up with Saskia after her presentation at the Chicago Humanities Festival. You said when you spoke to the Chicago Humanities Festival that globalization consists of an enormous variety of microprocesses that begin to denationalize what has been constructed as national, point you were just making. And you talked about, or you referenced policies, capital, politics, temporal frames, and urban spaces. I want you to talk about urban spaces in this context.
Well, I think the city captures this in a way that no other space captures this, because the city is the critical space where we can both detect these transformations and where these transformations get constituted. So the city space is a strategic space, and because it is a subnational space, it is to me an extremely interesting laboratory for understanding processes of denationalization that are not as formalized as the ones that happen inside the Federal Reserve and inside the Treasury and the trade representative, in the case of the United States, of the person in charge of WTO implementation, so, which capture that in a formalized way. In the space of the city, it is more anarchic. So there is a real research agenda, you know, anthropologists, ethnographers, culture, literature people who begin to capture these kinds of transformations. There, a wonderful dissertation that I was involved with at Chicago dealt with questions of cinema and literature in New York and in Tokyo, and how the world of culture begins to capture that. Well, culture is either an abstraction in books or in very formal sort of official culture, or it is something that is partly happening on the street and in a whole variety of settings, including bars and restaurants, you know, where other practices get instituted. Now, part of the global city function is to create a space where foreign firms, foreign investors, foreign professionals feel that they're almost at home. So the city, in that sense, captures something that, if you just looked at national law, it looks national. Very interesting example, and it's a simple one, that is why I will mention it, is when the United States begins this process of opening up to foreign firms and foreign investors, one of the things it instituted was international banking facilities, IBFs. Now, this goes back to the early 80s. Now, if you look at it on paper, this is national law, national legislation. But most of the international banking facilities, you know, they were basically in New York and some in Chicago. So in that sense, this is an example that in the case of global finance today becomes much more complicated to track down, because so much of finance happens in electronic networks. And so when I deal with that subject and the city, I ask, well, why do these global financial electronic networks need financial centers, such as the one in New York and in Chicago? What do they need it for? Well, the financial center nowadays, And I should say, just as background, that as globalization has expanded, as global finance has grown, it depends on an increasing global network of financial centers. There are now over 75 active financial centers that are a kind of structure within which global finance operates. So back to the question, why does global electronic finance need financial centers? It turns out that the financial center is an in-between space where the particular cultures and local notions of what is a good investment, how should we use our money, how should we, do that bit, bridges with these more standardized global notions. Many of them, by the way, made in New York and then circulated globally. The financial center plays a critical role in bringing down what is electronic, standard, and abstract into the thick setting of a city's, you know, economic notions, investment cultures, etc. So that is, again, a way in which this very complicated notion of global finance hits the ground and becomes real people. Because remember, say the traders in Chicago, you know, in the exchanges, these guys, they're local. They are not the derivatives trading people, etc., who are. They are local, and they have to really understand something. So they really bridge. They bridge between very thick local cultures of investment and these global, emergent global financial sort of systems and notions.
You referred to governing in an intelligent way, and that given the changes that are taking place today, that we need a different kind of governing. And I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit. How does government need to adapt to this changing world that we live in?
Well, first, there's a lot of homework to be done. Government, the leadership in government and the public administration, which in our country is over 800 agencies, they are part of government. They're often forgotten, but they are part of government. They've just got to do their homework and get a handle on the consequences of deregulating finance. I mean, we now know, for instance, that some elements of this crisis could have been avoided if we would have had better regulation of finance. Because, say, the crisis that has hit some of the other countries who have better regulation is partly a made-in-the-U.S. crisis that then has circulated globally like a viral infection. So we really have a problem in this country with getting a handle on what are the consequences of deregulating a whole variety of sectors. Telecommunications, deregulated, massive concentration now happening. So we have made enough history in terms of deregulating. There is enough evidence that shows the consequences of deregulating. Let's learn from that. That's number one. Number two, our country is headed really in the wrong direction. The bailout is an indication, the $700 billion bailout. Zero protection for the homeowners and maximum protection for the financial firms that contributed to the crisis. So what's the consequence at the level of territory? Neighborhood after neighborhood full of foreclosed properties. In the long run, that's not good for us. Workplace standards. We rank number 40 in the world in terms of serious workplace injury. I'm talking workplace injury, not home. One thing is at home, to regulate that, much more difficult. Workplace, we can regulate workplaces. To whose advantage is it that we have a third of our workplaces absolutely degraded, zero protections for workers? In the long run, this is all very, very negative. So we've got to take two things seriously. One is power, how to handle power in this country. We have not been good in this country about handling power. The power of telecommunication corporations, the power of finance, the power of the executive, frankly. Power we don't know how to handle it. The Europeans, for instance, are much better at handling power. I would say the Chinese are much better and the Japanese are much better at handling power. These are all countries that have massive concentrations of power, but they have known how to handle it. Second point, we need to return to a broader national perspective. It's not just the leading economic sectors that need protecting. It's all economic sectors that we need to make sure that they're functioning, that they're working in the long run. That is what we need. Government, in other words, has to really think in far broader terms than just sort of what seem to be the growth sectors at a given time. And that has been a bit the practice in this country, is to look at growth sectors and to assume out of that the third issue, the trickle-down. The trickle-down doesn't work. Right now we have trickle-up. I mean, it's as clear as that. There is no doubt about that.
And yet, in this most recent election, that's been called redistribution, that's been called socialism, that's been called communism. They're not only in our government, certainly, is there a lack of understanding of what's happening globally and these major shifts that are going on, but that's a reflection simply of the American public. I mean, you're an academic, and as you joke all the time, you say every book you write, you say, oh, it's boring. So how do you get that knowledge simplified in a way that the American public can pay attention and take it in, learn from it, and make decisions on it?
Well, I do every now and then give talks, you know, to more public audiences, and I try to be pretty simple. I do a rather good job on finance when I give my finance talk and bring it down to how we, the average citizen, can sort of deal with it. But I do think this has to be a collective project. What I really object to is that those who have a pulpit, and the punditry is part of that, the journalists are part of that, they should just be more serious about it. And the propagating of forms of ignorance, to call Obama a socialist, is so far off the mark. You know, for the Europeans, they see him as barely in the center and one foot on the right. And look, the European countries, that's not socialism either. That's just government that takes care of the vulnerable, if you want. Vulnerable economic sectors, vulnerable things like public transport, vulnerable things like bridges. We're talking infrastructure and we're talking basic public health care and public transport. There is nothing socialist about that. Our own country took better care of that. This is breeding ignorance, and this is breeding a kind of partisanship that makes us childish. Another version of how the city is a space that brings to the fore these kinds of issues. Imagine, let's go back to the demonstrations by the immigrants 2 years ago when our legislature was discussing criminalizing being undocumented, which means that, hey, if you're a criminal and you're discovered, you go to jail, it failed, by the way. Anyhow, you had these huge demonstrations. People in the city, standing with signs saying, I'm undocumented, but I have the right to have rights. Those same people, in other words, the same person, employees or workers on a, say, a farm in California, standing there, a group of 5 or 10, with a sign, the employer would have said, hey, just go back to work, or call the INS to deport them. So the city is also a space where certain possibilities emerge for the disadvantaged, for the powerless.
You talk about the city as possibility. Is that because of its anonymity? Is that because of the size of its population? Is it a function of public space? What is it about the city that makes it that vessel?
Well, it probably is a mix of all of those, but it is also two other things. One is the multitude. The multitude has emerged as a very significant option. Now, mind you, I'm a bit of a critic of that notion when I am in my academic mode, in the sense that when you say multitude, you're looking at it from the outside, right? There is the multitude. If you're inside the multitude, you don't experience it as a multitude. You experience all the differences and the particular objectives and aims. Let's say the wonderful Labor Day parades that they now do here in Chicago, right? May 1, where all kinds of very different groupings coalesce momentarily around something. So when you're inside the multitude, that is what you experience. The second issue that the city makes possible is a kind of internationalism that at the limit also denationalizes, in the sense that people who come often from very provincial settings within the country, the United States, or from outside, encounter each other. The immigrants, that's a clear case. The immigrants, when they come for the first time, they have a chance very often, especially if they're lower-income immigrants, to run into immigrants from all over the world. That is an extraordinary experience. It breeds cosmopolitanisms. You know, there are many different kinds of cosmopolitanisms. The city enables a whole variety of cosmopolitanisms, you know. And so what some people call vernacular cosmopolitanisms, or the sort of classical notion of cosmopolitanism, but also this kind of cosmopolitanism around people who don't even think of themselves as cosmopolitan, you know, who, but it is a kind of, and again, maybe the language of a partial denationalizing. They're no longer simply Guatemalans. They are part of a different kind of crowd. The city makes that possible. And finally, there is a way in which also the multitude, like when you have a demonstration, it's not only about making yourself visible to power, it's about discovering who you are. Back to the Labor Day parade, the May 1 Labor Day parade in Chicago. When they first did the parade, you know, when they restarted the parades, which was maybe about 10 years ago or 9 years ago, nobody knew who was going to come. And then what happened? All kinds of groups, including this one group of Colombians, there were three Colombians in Chicago who had been working on protesting some incarcerated prisoners in Colombia for the last 10 years. Well, they were no longer alone. They suddenly discovered all kinds of other groups, little groups, obsessed, because it takes obsession, you know, to pursue these kinds of struggles, with their own thing. And so the parade becomes a moment. It's a moment when they all become present to each other. The demonstrations of the migrants, you become present to each other. It's not just presence to power. Power should not always be the reason or the motive. You know, it is also about discovering. And in that process, you constitute a multitude, but from the inside, you know, not as a fancy category for us academics who gaze at the multitude, but you make it from the inside with all the diversities. The demonstrations that happened in over 600 places against the invasion of Iraq, you remember that famous in February? I mean, I was in the one in London, which was almost 1 million people. There were the most diverse types of groups. If we would have been sitting around a table, we would have killed each other for the differences in our ideas. It didn't matter. So the city enables these momentary, temporary arrangements, but they accumulate over time, and so you know that it can be done.
One more question, and that is about, given what you know about the global city, are we on a trajectory that can't be stopped, where some cities that have that status of global city are going to succeed, and those that do not have that status will continue to decline?
No, I don't think so. I mean, look, there are cities that are dying. Say, in Germany, a lot of manufacturing-centered cities, they are done. They're gone. They are now piles of cement that nobody knows what to do with. It's very dramatic. And, in fact, they have a special term for it in Germany. You know, in Germany, it's a big issue. In our country, we know about, you know, we know from an earlier era the ghost towns, right? The mining town that is gone. So that will happen. That has happened with a lot of smaller manufacturing firms. But here is my thing that was never quite understood in my analysis of the global city. I said, look, there is a foundational transformation that is happening in the economy, which is the growing demand for intermediate services, firm-to-firm services. The most familiar of those services are insurance, finance, etc. So if you are a mine, a stone quarry, a big steel plant, you're going to be buying more insurance today than you did 15 years ago, more financial services, more accounting, more legal. At one end, this can all be rather local or regional. It doesn't have to be global. And we have all kinds of smaller cities that are precisely that. And you see a growth of this professional class, which brings in money into the cities. It also brings in inequalities, but, you know. And at the other end, it is the extreme version of the global city, where it becomes acute. So in the United States, we now have New York and Chicago, two powerful global cities. But we have hundreds of cities where you see that same syndrome. Now, often the quickest and first view is gentrification. So you see, you know, the fancy restaurants, the fancy bars, the people who want to live inside the city, you see that happening all over the country. And a lot of that is linked to national trends. But at the heart of it is this growing demand for high-level professionals, not the little accountant of, you know, the typical, most accountants are like that, but this new kind of, which is really working for firms. And you can see it in the national input-output tables. You see this growth, whether they are transport, hospitals, no matter what entity, they are buying more specialized services from other firms. And so again, I repeat, at one end, it's a national, regional, and at the other end, it's a global city, you know, totally global. Now, at the level of global cities, we've just finished two huge studies. One was presented here in Chicago not too long ago, which shows that now we have about 70, 75 major and minor global cities around the world, because that is a platform for the global economy, for global culture, for the globalizing of the art market, for all kinds of things. It's not just finance. And for me, one of the issues is that the irony, perhaps, is that in this phase of globalization, it's the differences of cities that become valued. You know, people are talking always about the homogenizing of the urban economy. That's only partly true. Part of the confusing element is that we have indeed homogenized the standards for building state-of-the-art office districts, airports, hotels. In my reading, that state-of-the-art built environment that we see in city after city after city, no matter how fancy the architect and how original the design, the silhouette of the building, that standardized state-of-the-art built environment is actually an infrastructure. It is needed, but it's not clear what it will be used for. When the Woolworth building came up, it talked a clear language. It said, I'm about office work, and that was enough. Nowadays, it's not enough. We don't know exactly what's happening. Take Chicago and New York, take finance. There is a built environment, they need certain kinds of infrastructure, etc., to do finance. But New York and Chicago are two very different financial centers. Take China, Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, and Hong Kong, the four major cities in China. They're all global cities now. Fantastically different. But the built environment, you see a certain kind of state-of-the-art office district. You see it in all four of these cities. But in each case, they are doing something very different. So for me, one of the under-observed, under-worked-with trends, and it's an interesting one for cities, is that as we globalize, the differences of cities become more valued than they were under the Keynesian period, which had a national territorial project, which was good, mind you, but when cities were basically more routinized administrative centers. And the places, the institutional places where the real innovations were happening, were the government, by developing the social contract, the welfare state, etc., workplace protections, and mass manufacturing. Those were the sites of innovation. That is in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s. And now it's the city. It's a more complex element. The city emerges as significant. So if you took any of these cities, of these global cities, and you try to understand, this is what I do in my research, what are the global circuits that this city is located on, you will see two things. You will see that they will have multiple global circuits that run through them. You know, one could link with finance, another one with art, whatever. And that in each of these global circuits on which a given city is located on, say, Chicago, there are different kinds of cities to which they are connected. If you do that for, say, 20 major cities, you get a very concrete sense, not only of the global, whether it's global culture, global entertainment, whatever, but also of how each of these cities is different. So my big question then, coming back to cities, is how can we make this more visible so that people stop talking about the urban economy gets homogenized? How about switching the language and saying the built environment no longer speaks the language that it used to speak, where an office building was an office building and that's all you needed to know? That's the period of the 60s. Hey, office building. Today, that built environment is actually very indeterminate. It's homogenized in its basic state of the artness, but it is not in terms of how it gets used.
Saskia Sassen is professor of sociology at Columbia University and at the London School of Economics. Her books include The Global City, Cities in a World Economy, and her newest book, Territory, Authority, and Rights, From Medieval to Global Assemblages. Now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn always to Nate Berg of PlanEdison.com.
Urban planners, your dream may be coming true. Word is out that President-elect Barack Obama is making moves to establish a White House Office of Urban Policy. The announcement came this week from Obama transition co-chair Valerie Jarrett, who says this will be a high-profile department focusing on city issues and providing a comprehensive approach to urban development. It's a move planners are calling long overdue. The Department of Housing and Urban Development was set up by President Lyndon Johnson in 1965 to tackle city and housing policy, but the city part kind of dropped off the radar as the years went on. Obama's administration hopes the new Office of Urban Policy will bring that attention back. Speculation abounds as to who will fill Obama's cabinet, and no names have been listed for the urban policy post as of yet. Meanwhile, a point-counterpoint at Building Design Online debates whether shopping centers can be viable tools for city regeneration. A retail developer and an architect trade points, arguing that retail is either the cause of or the cure for urban decay. By creating a sense of place, the developer argues, shopping centers are reviving the demand for public spaces in which to engage and creating walkable areas that encourage interaction. On the architect's side, shopping centers are chastised for draining the life out of neighboring areas and hurting local economies and small businesses. It's argued that any economic gains are often offset by a corporate takeover of the community in question. Whether cities should rely on shopping centers for regeneration is clearly debatable, but essentially it all comes down to what cities are looking to gain and what they're willing to give up. And finally, this Christmas may not be so jolly, as cities and companies across the country are scrimping on holiday decorations to save some extra cash. The Wall Street Journal reports that cities and businesses are stringing up fewer Christmas lights and downsizing or completely eliminating holiday parties amid a tight economic slowdown. From Michigan to Florida to Tennessee, small cities are being forced to make cuts to traditional holiday festivities as city budgets decline and homeowners face extreme mortgage troubles. Even elf and Santa Claus bookings are on the decline, as the impact of reduced property taxes and a struggling economy take their toll on cities across the country. Americans may be facing at least 1 year without a Santa Claus. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with Richard Longworth. His latest book, Caught in the Middle, is about globalization's effects on the Midwest. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City.
Hi, I'm Scotty Iseri, and if you're hearing my voice right now, it means you're listening to the podcast version of Smart City. And I have a message specifically for you, the podcast listener. We usually get a lot of really great comments via email from our listeners. They have questions about the show, things they heard. They have comments about things we got wrong or things we got right. Really intelligent input. And we thought, why don't we create a space online where our listeners can talk to each other? That's why we've created My City. My City is a social networking site for urban enthusiasts, people that love cities, people that want to see cities thrive, people that have ideas about making the next great city. So, how do you join? You send me an email. My personal email, I'm giving this out, Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com. send me an email. I'll send you an invite. Join the conversation online. One more time, it's scotty@smartcityradio.com. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Richard Longworth is a veteran journalist and is now senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He's also an author, and his latest book is Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. I started our conversation by asking him, where is America's heartland?
That's one of the problems with the Midwest. It's so hard to define. It sort of trickles off into the east on one end and into the Great Plains on the other. You can say in the north it looks like Canada, in the south it sounds like the Ozarks. For my purposes, I made it sort of the north central. That is the states from Ohio through Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa, probably over the Mississippi River a bit, but after that you get into the Great Plains. Then Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, the northern half of Missouri. South of that, you're getting into the south, as indeed you are in the southern third of some of the other states like Illinois and Indiana. This is a little impressionistic, but I have to say I haven't had any complaints except for the folks in Buffalo and Pittsburgh who are offended at being left out. They say the Midwest problems are our problems too, and we want to be part of this conversation.
Describe the impact of globalization on the American Midwest.
We do two big things for a living, which is intensive agriculture and heavy industry. And globalization is tossing both of them right up in the air. The heavy industry, the assembly line stuff, the heavy manufacturing that we have always lived on in this part of the world, not just Ohio and Michigan, but Wisconsin and Illinois and Iowa too, that's the stuff that's being outsourced. A lot of it went south during the Rust Belt. It got hit hard during the Japanese challenge. But right now, what's going on, the outsourcing of this kind of heavy industry that we've always lived on, is putting the final nail in the coffin.
I mean, should we be mourning the death of small towns? More importantly, should we be imagining for them a different future? Or do we simply accept the inevitability, like mine towns, that they had their time and they now have no economic function?
Carol, every town that you can think of, maybe the exception would be a place like Washington, which was born as a capital city. But every town you can think of, every city you can think of, is there for an economic reason, because of a mine or a port or a railroad or a factory. First we have jobs. First we're a labor pool, and then we're a city, and then we're a civilization. And if that reason, the economic reason for existence, goes away, then the city goes away too. Places have to support themselves unless they can reinvent themselves, which Chicago is in the process of doing right now quite successfully. If these small towns can't reinvent themselves, a lot of them are going to die out. And should we mourn this? I don't know if we should or not. I do. I come from one of those towns out in Iowa. It's struggling. It's holding on as a bedroom suburb for Des Moines. But it's lost its basic, the railroads and the farms that made it what it was. And I mourn this because it's the departure of a way of life. But it is happening, and a lot of the small towns around the Midwest are going to die out. Again, this has been going on for a long time. I spent an instructive day a few years ago going to Bethlehem and New York in the same day. These are two little towns down in southeastern Iowa. And once upon a time, there were both about 2,000 or 3,000 people with stores and doctors and schools and all that. Now, today, they are a church surrounded by cornfields, and that's it. There is there's almost an organic process here. Some places are doing fine. Minneapolis, Des Moines doing all right. Omaha, less of an industrial legacy to overcome. Some places are trying to reinvent themselves. Akron, Ohio is one. Peoria, Illinois is another. Grand Rapids, Michigan is doing pretty well. Other places, you go to some of these towns in Ohio. I don't know if you knew, but 6 out of the 7 biggest towns, biggest cities in Ohio have all lost more than half their population. Columbus is the one exception. And you go to some of these places, Mansfield, Youngstown, Springfield, Dayton, you wonder, do they have a future? The earth isn't going to open up and swallow them. They're not going to disappear totally. But if you live there, and if you're raising kids there, your kids wouldn't stay there, and not much reason for you to stay there either.
What separates those cities that have been able to reinvent themselves and to reinvent their economic purpose from those that have not?
Cities that can get it together, literally speaking, have a leg up here. Peoria is an example. As you know, back in the 80s and 90s, Peoria, UAW, and Caterpillar went through a couple of ruinous strikes and pretty much figured, you know, turn out the lights in Peoria. People down there got together. These are business leaders, economic development people, Bradley University, which never played that big a role in the economy of the city. The UAW got on board. The city government is there, but not taking the lead. All these people acting together are working to bring Peoria back, and they've got something going. Some places that are making it are beneficiaries of what I call the sugar daddy phenomenon. Grand Rapids is an example. Grand Rapids lost a lot of its auto and furniture manufacturing. They got the two families up there, the DeVoses and Van Andels, that founded Amway, who have put a ton of money into medical research up there. And in Grand Rapids now, they have this medical mile right down the middle of the city. There's a lot going on. The one thing they didn't have was a really first-class research university, which you need for something like this. So they went off to Lansing and persuaded Michigan State University to hive off part of its medical school and move it to Grand Rapids. That's pretty good going. Another thing that seems to be working, sometimes you find cities that have lost everything, that their past has gone, and then they build on the past. And what I mean by that is they say, we don't do this anymore, but what do we know? Akron, Ohio, perfect example. They don't make tires in Akron anymore, a few specialty racing tires, but that's about it. But they know polymers, you know, the molecules that go into making rubber and a lot of other things. So they, working with the University of Akron and working with some of the old tire companies that are still there, are working together, and they've got quite a start on a good little polymers industry. Down in Peoria, you know, they used to make whiskey there, Hiram Walker. They don't do that anymore, but in Peoria they say, we know fermentation. And fermentation, that's biosciences. And away they go. There's been a couple of articles recently about the Midwest making use of one of its big natural resources, which is wind, to become a center of alternative energy technology, wind power, solar power, biofuels, that sort of thing. There was a story in the paper recently about Newton, Iowa. When I was in Newton, Newton was down and out. It's Maytag. You know, that's all there was in Newton was Maytag, and Maytag closed a year ago. And Newton didn't know what it was going to do for a living. Well, they've talked to a couple of companies that build parts for wind turbines, have come in there, and it's doing pretty well. I was up in Greenville, Michigan, which was Electrolux. And I was up there on the day the Electrolux factory closed and nobody knew what they were going to do. Well, it got quite a bit of ink and papers, and somebody phoned them up and said, we run a company that makes solar panels, and we'd like to put 6 solar panels in Greenville, each of them providing 200 jobs. 2 of those factories are up and running now. That's 1,200 jobs. Doesn't replace the 3,000 or so jobs that were lost at Electrolux, but it does mean that Greenville probably has a future.
I was talking with Saskia Sassen recently, and she made the point that cities have to know deeply, understand deeply where they fit in the global distribution or the global network, and that they have to understand their particularity. In other words, where they fit into the global economy versus some other city. So in some ways, she was urging cities to set aside the tendency to copy or to follow best practices and really to try to understand deeply their own opportunities. And I think, you know, you've pointed that out, for instance, with Akron, what Akron has done. I'm curious, what is it about the culture of, say, a Chicago, a Minneapolis, that sets those cities apart and enables them to transform in big, big ways, say, versus a Cleveland or a Detroit? What's the difference in those two sets of cities?
Oh, Carol, those would be books on their own right there. Minneapolis has never been a big industrial city, so it had less of the brownfield past to overcome. It's largely doing what it's always done. It's got geographical, I mean, globalization, global cities are geographical in nature. They tend to dominate hinterlands around them. And Minneapolis is the big apple between Chicago and the West Coast. Chicago is such an interesting place on this because we were down and out. And Saskia has pointed out that we have built on our past. We don't have stockyards anymore. But what we do know is how to trade pork bellies. Well, we may not trade pork bellies anymore, but we know trading. And it's the trading on LaSalle Street, which is going through a hard time right now. But it was all these new global derivatives, a cooperation between LaSalle Street and the people at the University of Chicago, making use of what Chicago knows, that enabled LaSalle Street to really plant the seed of this Chicago recovery. Another thing. We don't have much industry anymore. All this industry has gone away. But we know industry. If you're a global industrial company and manufacturing all around the world, but you really want good advice and good leadership from people who know about industry, you come here. We've got lawyers who know industry, accountants, consultants, PR people, all expert in industry. Not so hot maybe in bioscience or high tech, but on heavy industry. That's what we know. So our industry has gone away and we're still living on it. Saskia's made that point, and I think it's very valid. Why not Cleveland or Detroit? Maybe one industry towns. Pretty much lack of local leadership. A lack of cooperation between the political and business structure. Or lack of understanding of what's going on. I was amazed. I spent some time in Cleveland doing my research, and it was the only big city I was in where nobody wanted to talk about globalization, almost as though it doesn't exist. They really don't realize that they're in a global competition. They're still arguing about the same stuff they were arguing about 20 or 30 years ago. They think that, you know, it's a little local disturbance, Sunbelt stuff in this industry will come back. Or they look at the Cleveland Clinic and say healthcare, you know, that's going to be it. You just have the feeling they don't understand it.
It sounds like you're really saying dig deep into what you know and then abstract that so that you can get to a point that's abstract enough to work with today's economy.
I think better just look at your assets. Who have you got around who's smart? What do the old companies know? What universities that you have? And as you know, universities and businesses are totally different cultures. And it's been very hard in the past to get them to work together. Well, in a lot of these towns, people are realizing they're going to have to overcome this. I stress they're beginning to realize this. I'm not saying they've actually got the job done, but they're working at it. But what are your assets? What are your natural assets? We've never made much use out of this terrific natural asset right at our front door, the greatest freshwater resource in the world, the Great Lakes here. Up in Milwaukee, they are beginning to think about doing something about this. What economic benefit can we get from it? 20 years from now, anybody who wants to live or set up business somewhere where they have a reliable source of fresh water is going to have to do it here. What can we do with this? You have to get cities involved, but I think the universities have to take the lead, economic development people have to take the lead, regional economic development people have to take the lead, and we'll see where it comes from there.
Have you seen examples of multi-state partnerships that impress you? You talk about the Midwest as an entity, and it's certainly multi-state. I would assume that you also think the answer to the Midwest economic challenges are multi-state. Fair statement? And if so, what has to happen to make those multi-state partnerships come into being?
Carol, I got to tell you, going around the Midwest, talking with people, I was astonished at how balkanized we are. The fact that you can talk to somebody, a real expert, an academic or a business person or state government official in, say, Indiana, who knows everything there is to know about Indiana and is totally ignorant of what's going on across the state line right next door in Ohio or Michigan. People don't have this kind of cooperation. Most of our biggest cities are on the edge of their states, not in the center. But they don't, except for, you know, a little accidental spread across St. Louis spreading into Illinois, that sort of thing. There isn't an awful lot of cooperation. The state line, Kansas-Missouri state line, runs right down the middle of a street in Kansas City. And you think those two halves of the city, those two states, would cooperate? They don't do this, and I think this is really the future. Let me give a hometown example here. Chicago, the Chicago Economic Region, starts north of Milwaukee. Runs down through Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, down through Chicago, curls around the lake through northern Indiana and on to South Bend and up to Grand Rapids. This is a four-state area. And believe me, we sit here and we in Chicago and tend to ignore these other places. The folks in Milwaukee have almost seceded mentally from the state of Wisconsin. They know where they belong. Ditto with Grand Rapids. They feel themselves as part of the Chicago region, and they don't have a lot to do with Detroit or eastern Michigan. Okay, when are we going to start taking advantage of this? We have planning agencies like CMAP or M7 for each state, and they do a little cooperation. But they really should be one big agency. When are we going to get rail networks, high-speed rail, to tie this together? When are we going to talk about cooperation on infrastructure, on education, on setting up the conditions to draw in the kind of industries we want? We have a lot of strengths around here, including a lot of big businesses, a lot of natural resources, a lot of universities, but we don't, you know, all this adds up to much less than the sum of its parts.
So many companies headquartered in the Midwest are, in fact, global companies. I mean, they're thinking globally. What would it take for the Midwest as a region, as a people, as a collection of governments and universities and foundations to reimagine the Midwest as a global player?
First, we have to start thinking of ourselves as a global player. I talked about the balkanization and the mutual ignorance that we have and the sort of mindless competitiveness. We have to start thinking of ourselves as a region. The South does this and has been doing it quite successfully. New England does it. The Rocky Mountain states do it. We can do this, but we have to get the conversation going. Now, you know, I'm over at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and we have just set up something called the Global Midwest Initiative, which will be kind of a think tank. Commissioning papers on Midwestern issues, getting people to come together to talk on this, having seminars and that sort of thing. But basically, what we want this to be is a table, a forum where people can come together from around the Midwest simply to talk about common issues, tell common war stories, possibly come up with some common solutions. This sounds very basic, and it is, but nobody's doing it now. It just doesn't. There is no Midwestern conversation, and at least we're going to get that started, and let's see where we go from there.
Lou Glaser at Michigan Future has made much of the fact that too many people in that state, the state of Michigan, have no education ambition for themselves or their children. For Lou, it's in part a cultural problem. Is that part of the problem that you see in the Midwest, a cultural problem?
Very much so. We did have this Silicon Valley here 100 years ago, when we had all these great ideas and great inventions, and they set up these big corporations, and we've been living on these great ideas and inventions ever since for 100 years. Sons follow fathers, follow grandfathers in the same mill. Business schools turned out people who knew how to run big old businesses, not how to start lively new ones. Cities got their steady source of tax income, didn't have to think of something new. So these old guys were so innovative and so imaginative that we've been living on their inventions ever since, meaning that we've never had to come up with any new ideas, and we've forgotten how. We simply have lost the knack of innovation. At the same time, all this was very stable. These companies were here. They're big companies. They weren't going anywhere, or so we thought. So things were very stable, and we prize this sort of stable form of life, and I think that is the cultural thing. You know, your family, your third generation in an assembly line. And you own your own home, and you got a couple cars, you got a cottage by the lake, you take vacations, you're living kind of a middle-class standard of life, you did this with a high school education. Hey, what's good enough for me is good enough for my kid. And I suspect Lou was talking about this poll that they took up in Michigan, in which they found that 65% of the parents in the state of Michigan did not see higher education as crucial to their children's future well-being. Not that they were hostile to it. They just didn't see the point. And this you have to change around. Now, this is Michigan. I went to Ohio and Indiana, and I told people there about this poll. And at first they gasped, and then I said, you know, you took a similar poll here, what would it be? And they said, well, yeah, about the same. Probably a little bit better further west in Iowa and Minnesota, but still you have a blue-collar way of life that isn't there anymore. You have new industries like this, wind power industries, like the biosciences and biotech, it's going to take PhDs, but it's also going to take workers with at least 2 years of post-high school education. And this is in an area that has never thought this way. So this is all part of this education of convincing Midwesterners, and they're ready to be convinced, that the old days are gone, that something new is here, that they are in competition daily and hourly with people all around the world, that the old jobs aren't coming back, that the new jobs are the ones we create ourselves, and we have to be pretty smart to run them.
We've just gone through this presidential campaign, and of course, much of the focus always is on Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan, these old economies that you say, when we all know, need to be transformed. How do you talk about this to people who are feeling that their way of life slipping away, they're losing their jobs, they're trying to hang on by their fingernails, they're in their 40s, they're in their 50s. How do you bridge that gap and help them understand that what they've done in the past is no longer enough to get them ahead in the future?
Oh, Carol, I don't know how you do that. I remember years ago when the steel mills closed here in Chicago. And a lot of the people who worked there just left town. The others take the Skyway out. And the person taking the toll in the Skyway booth would be a great big guy of about 40 years old. And you just knew where he'd come from. It's kind of at a certain age, a lot of these people who worked these assembly lines weren't that well-educated. And a lot of them aren't retrained. A lot of these new jobs in Newton and Greenville and places like that are going to their kids, not to these people. There is a future for the kids. It is a cruel, cruel process because these are people who always played by the rules and now do see their lives being yanked out from under them. You remember during the primaries, Obama and Clinton had a lot of negative things to say about NAFTA. And they were going to change NAFTA and all that. I think I know where they're coming from on this. Because they were talking to the same people during the primaries that I've been talking to during my research. And you go talk to a factory manager or a factory worker or a mayor and you say, what's the problem here? And everybody say, NAFTA. NAFTA's the problem. And I begin to realize that's an awful lot of blame to put on one poor little old trade treaty. Basically, globalization is a great, big, new complicated, complex process. It's really hard to get your arms and your mind around it. So when people are saying NAFTA, what they're really saying is something's happening to our lives and we don't like it very much. NAFTA is kind of shorthand for globalization. So we have a terrific job to support the people who are a lost generation on this, and I'm afraid they are, to convince them their kids need the education, to convince cities and states and regions and universities that the old ways that suffice so well during the industrial age won't work anymore, and that we have to really reinvent our lives and our economy and our region. Other parts of the world are doing this. Other parts of the world have done this. A lot of the European regions are doing this. South did it after suffering for 100 years after the Civil War. We can do this, but first off, we have to start realizing what we're up against and think real hard about it.
Dick, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Carol, thank you.
Richard Longworth is senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He's also a former journalist at the Chicago Tribune and author of the book, Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. With the historic election of Barack Obama, many people are bidding a fond farewell to President Bush, but our City Views commentator Walker Smith is saying goodbye to a different executive officer, President Bartlet.
Tuesday night, Election Day, my sister emailed me minutes after Barack Obama concluded his victory speech in Chicago's Grant Park. Finally, she wrote, I can quit playing reruns of West Wing. For the last 8 years, Martin Sheen has been my president. My sister is nothing if not blunt. But after listening to Obama that night myself, I felt something similar. Obama addressed the nation for the first time as president-elect Tuesday night. He spoke repeatedly of hope, change, and unity, the themes of his campaign, as he quoted Lincoln and made allusions to the speeches of both FDR and JFK. But his words soared highest when he twice echoed the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. From Dr. King's affirmation on the steps of the Alabama State Capitol in 1965 that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice, Obama fashioned an image of people putting their hands on the arc of history to bend it once more toward the hope of a better day. Even more stirring was Obama's confident assurance that though the road ahead will be long and our climb steep, we as a people will get there. Words that harken back to the haunting prophetic closing lines of Dr. King's last speech the night before he was killed. I want you to know tonight, he said, that we as a people will get to the promised land. By sounding two refrains of Dr. King's words, Barack Obama was making clear his belief that Americans, as they always have, even in the darkest times, can rise to the daunting challenges ahead. My sister was hooked. She doesn't need Aaron Sorkin anymore to inspire her with words of courage and vision, as our leaders should. Barack Obama spoke to the world that night. To all those watching tonight from beyond our shores, he said, from parliaments and palaces, to those who are huddled around radios in the forgotten corners of the world, our stories are singular, but our destiny is shared, and a new dawn of American leadership is at hand. He continued, to those who would tear the world down, we will defeat you. To those who seek peace and security, we support you. And to all those who have wondered if America's beacon still burns as bright, tonight we proved once more that the true strength of our nation comes not from the might of our arms or the scale of our wealth, but from the enduring power of our ideals, democracy, liberty, opportunity, and unyielding hope. Obama drew to a close with a challenge. This is our chance to answer the call, he said. This is our moment. And where we are met with cynicism and doubts and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. This sort of inspiration is sorely needed today. There is a dread weighing upon the American spirit. It is seen in every poll as an utter collapse of confidence and a yearning for a new direction. It was in evidence Tuesday night as millions of Americans literally danced in the streets after Obama's victory. It is even the reason for the October crash in retail sales. Americans are spooked and retrenching. Before any new era can begin, the American verve must be recharged. Obama was criticized throughout his campaign for his oratorical finesse, but it is not to be dismissed. We need that as much as anything right now, and if my sister is any indication, his words have already begun to have the desired effect. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. Want to hear more from our guest and more about their work? Go to our website, smartcityradio.com, and subscribe to our podcast. This week, we'll have extended interviews with our guest, Saskia Sassen and Richard Longworth. And while you're there, you can listen to archive shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. Most importantly, you can get in touch with us and let us know how we're doing. Please click on the contact button or email us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He only had to wait an hour to vote last week. I'm Carol Coletta.